Welcome everybody to Safeguarding in Focus. It's a brand new podcast brought to you by CPOMS, the market leading safeguarding software. I'm your host, Sam Eustace. You'll have seen me on some of the webinars and stuff that we've done previously. And for our very first episode, we're going to be discussing the importance of trauma-informed approaches to support children's mental health with our guest, Dr. Asha Patel, who'll be sharing all the valuable insights. So Asha's a clinical psychologist and a CEO of Innovating Minds. It's a multi-award-winning social enterprise dedicated to early intervention in mental health. Drawing on clinical experience in forensic mental health, Asha launched Innovative Minds in 2016 to bridge the gap between clinical experts and accessible community support. Their work empowers schools and communities by delivering trauma-informed psychological services that promote emotional well-being. Thank you for joining us, Asha. It's great to have you on.
Thank you, Sam, for welcoming me, especially for the first episode too.
Well, with that in mind then, I guess if we start at the beginning, there's a vast amount of stuff on the CV there that we talked about in that little intro, and there's far more to you than the stuff that we've talked about now. What inspired you to pursue a career in clinical psychology and subsequently working with children, families and young people?
So in all honesty, I didn't even know what a clinical psychologist was until after I finished my degree and got my first assistant psychologist post. So it wasn't that I was always wanting to be a clinical psychologist. My interest stemmed from being around people. So from a young age, I grew up in the family business. We had shops. So I used to do my homework in the shop with the shopkeeper, Peggy. And no. People would come in, customers would come in, and we'd hear all about the gossip that's going on the street. So it was a little corner shop on a local street. And he was having what affair and what was going on and just the fascination with people. And I started reading a book by Paul Britton, The Jigsaw Man. And he is a forensic profiler. And I think probably everybody back in the day wanted to work in forensic profiling. They'd watch something on TV. But there was a fascination of understanding why had people committed crimes, really serious crimes. Mm-hmm. Got complex mental health difficulties, and how do you piece that together? So originally, actually, I wanted to be a forensic profiler, and then I got some work experience in the police during the summer holidays and quickly realized there's no such thing. He basically created a job for himself, but it wasn't really something that I did. Right. I did raid some homes for drugs and stuff whilst I was in the with the police, and so it's really exciting. Wow. So I went off to uni, studied psychology and criminology because I knew I wanted to work with people that had got complex mental health difficulties and completed really serious offences. At this point, I still didn't know what a clinical psychologist was or what the route was for. I studied at uni, I came out and I got my first job in a prison service. I think I was naive, I was, 21? Worked in prison. My first day, they ask you to write a will. They gave you a whistle and saying, well, we don't negotiate with the prisoners. So if they take you hostage, this is what's going to happen.
Wow.
But yeah, I loved it. I love working with the people inside the prisons. It was a category B prison. But my frustration was that I was just churning out group-based interventions. So I left and then worked in psychiatric rehab again, still not knowing what a clinical psychologist was. And I worked in an inpatient service for people that were deemed as revolving door patients in the NHS. They'd come in and out of hospitals, psychiatric hospitals, and weren't really on their journey of rehabilitation. So I worked for an independent sector. And really noticed actually that with the resource and with the support that we could actually support their rehabilitation and get them to access the community. So we were stepping down these people, we were stabilizing the mental health, we were integrating them into the community, rebuilding relationships with family. And it wasn't until somebody said to me, are you applying for the doctorate this year? And I was like, oh, should I be? Which is a clinical doctorate course to become a psychologist. Highly competitive, didn't really know anything about it. And everyone else was doing it. So I thought, oh, I might as well. So then I started to pursue then looking at my options. Do I want to be a forensic psychologist? Because that's working in forensics where my initial interests were. Or actually clinical psychology where I could go into general mental health, but also then go into specialising forensics. So trained as a clinical psychologist, for me, gave me more options in terms of where I could work. Okay. So, yeah, at the age of 24, I got on the doctorate course. I was the youngest on the course.
Wow, yeah, congratulations. Thank you.
But I think it's because I wasn't chasing it and wanted it so much. Some people around me, they was pursuing the course, and actually they became unwell because of the stress.
So they were just so blinded, focused on that course and getting that and getting through the entry process and getting on the
Whereas
course.
For me, I enjoyed already what I was doing. Like it wasn't like I've got to be a clinical psychologist. I feel like it found me, and I know that sounds cheesy, but I really didn't know.
It makes a lot of sense, and it's interesting, isn't it? We talk about safeguarding all the time, and you know, it's a big push of the things that we do and the domains that we're in. It's really interesting hearing your story up to this point. It's kind of been grounded in an element of curiosity that's taking you on that journey moving on. And, you know, professional curiosity is a big part of the safeguarding process. And it's interesting how that kind of bookends everything that you're doing. You got to this point by being curious about the next bit and kind of moving on with, I guess, what resonated with you internally. It made sense to go that way. And there'll be some people out there in the audience who, you know, when people say teaching is like a vocation, and you know, they love what you do, and it's kind of, you know, cut yourself open and you bleed education. You know, the people I've worked with, the most impactful people are those who've, you know, live and breathe the things that they're doing. It sounds like you were very similar in the way that you approached your career, which is nice. You don't have to just think, I want to be this from 18. You know, you can explore the world and opportunities out there.
And around me, it wasn't that, because in where I grew up and in the Asian culture, it's accountancy, it's doctor, medicine, it's law, it's what those subjects. So when I said I'm going to do psychology, there wasn't really an interest from those around me of like, what even is that? What does
Absolutely.
That mean? And it's only until I become a doctor that then the community around me start to take interest. So it's really interesting, because actually there's also these cultural barriers, I guess, around understanding mental health, mental ill health,
and Absolutely, yeah.
perceptions of it. And I think that feeds into safeguarding, because of those biases that people might hold, or what we think is okay or not, or kind of a threshold around what we've seen, will impact on how we respond as well from a safeguarding perspective.
Absolutely. And you're absolutely right. Like, that stepping away from what would be seen as traditional and the norm is probably something that we need to consider anyway in the future, just in terms of how we manage young people, safeguarding, we approach it, things in schools. You know, everything's evolving super quickly. And you know, you've been doing this work for a long time now, and you've come at it from a very unique angle. I have a background in early years trauma abuse and working in those areas before I joined CPOMS. But my experience from getting into the career was from more kind of work within schools, consultative work, and growing through different careers kind of aside schools, rather than coming at it from a more clinical perspective. It's interesting to hear that you're kind of getting into this position now where you've been able to see through innovative minds and through the work that you're doing everything from a slightly different lens. You know, I'd imagine the forensic and clinical background that you have paints quite a unique picture on the way that you work and you operate. And it's been a really helpful background. But from your perspective, though, how do you think the mental health landscape for children and young people has changed over the last few years, you know, since you've been around in this area and working in this field?
Yeah, so when I set up Innovating Minds, it's come 10 years ago, I came out of inpatient mental health in clinical settings. So when I bounced into education, I was like, wow. Like, some of the practices, some of the presentations that you see would be, I guess, dealt with very differently, seen very differently in healthcare. We also have a multidisciplinary team in those settings. And then you come into education, and all of a sudden you don't have that. But actually it felt more riskier, because now you've got children with presenting mental health difficulties, some with very complex needs presented. Okay. risk, associated risk, without the support and the expertise and the training and the infrastructure around them. So when I guess 10 years ago, some of the main difficulties we're seeing were mainly talked around with like anxiety disorder. It might be separation anxiety. It was typically secondary age children as well. Whereas now when we look back, my gosh, we're seeing younger children, mm-hmm. primary schools that we're supporting with children that are experiencing suicide ideation, actively engaging in suicide ideation. We've got young people self-harming from primary, secondary plus.
Wow.
We've got disordered eating, or if not eating disorders as well, that are presenting. Got mood related, so depression. So now the young people of what we see now as before has completely changed. And I always battle this kind of question. Is it changed? Has it got worse? As a society, is our young people's mental health, is it getting worse? Or is it that we've raised awareness around mental ill health and look out for the signs and the symptoms? But as a result of that raising awareness, more people are now aware that they're unwell. And what hasn't followed suit is the access to help.
Interesting that, isn't it? Because you touched on a point I was just thinking about there, which, you know, because the landscape of time that you're talking about there, that chronology of events from about 10 years ago, is such a unique, I think, a unique set of circumstances over 10 years that have hit the world, the UK, children under your kind of care and guidance, in that we had understanding growth. I guess 10 years ago, keeping children safe was still relatively young. We had different approaches coming through for mental health support, wellbeing, different types of curriculum popping up, but nothing substantial at that point. Then fast forward a little bit further and we get the pandemic and the hit of the pandemic for a massive period of time. And what felt like from working in the field at the time in schools, like a sudden like shift to things being different. And I was going to ask, you know, exactly the point you raised. Do you feel like things are different, or does it feel like we're just better at finding things and better at being, I guess, curious and inquisitive and better at understanding things earlier to try and catch it quicker? And I guess are we less concerned now about the stigma attached by looking at children at a younger age? I feel like primary wasn't always ready when I worked in primary to look at mental health as a primary issue. I don't know, what are your thoughts?
I think definitely we've become more curious, which is great. And I also feel like it's been forced upon us because it's present, it's in our face. It's often those children that are deemed as naughty, risk of exclusion. I mean, I was just on the phone this morning with a school, exactly the same difficulty, young person, primary age child, risk of exclusion. But now where it's changing is they're recognising the impact of trauma. So 10 years ago, I was talking about trauma-informed practice, was talking about action, let's not focus on diagnosis, let's have a look at the underlying function of the symptoms that are presenting for this young person. And that was a difficult conversation. I also spoke to head teachers that outrightly said, you know what, we don't have any mental health problems in our school.
Okay.
There was no...
Bold statement.
Bold statement. There was no way of kind of thinking, actually, it's a good use of my resource to try and convince them otherwise.
It's a tough challenge, yeah, like you say, I'm here for 4 hours this week. I don't want to spend three of them having an argument.
I'm trying to convince you, because if that's what you believe, you're the head, then actually I'm just going to be banging my head of kind of, it's just not going to go further. So what I'm seeing now is this more curiosity around, well, what else is going on? Now, I feel like because of the nature and the more complex mental health difficulties coupled in with SEN needs, and we've got this diagnosis taking place around autism, ADHD, and what we do know is symptoms related around ADHD, autism also very similar to symptoms presented of young people that have experienced trauma, childhood trauma, difficulties with attention, relationships, emotional affect. So people becoming more curious and actually now saying, I'm not sure. Or they're saying, actually, I'm trauma aware, but not trauma informed. Or we've got this basic mental health awareness knowledge, but this goes beyond my expertise.
So the baseline understanding of the population who are helping us support these young people is the baseline knowledge has improved.
Baseline.
There are broader knowledge and understanding. Still, you know, many would argue that the expectation of teachers and staff to be more clinical and more like clinicians is definitely increasing, but it's probably an argument for another podcast. But I think we don't always touch on this because of the ed tech solution and because of the education working with schools, but do you feel like the attitude awareness and general understanding from parents as a whole is in a different place over the last 10 years of your work? How much contact you've had with parents and carers?
Parents and carers has always been quite tricky, and it still is, I'd say. I haven't seen a huge shift in that. And that's when we do a lot of work in domestic abuse, supporting children and young people affected by domestic abuse, and how do we provide that early trauma-informed support. What we get in school settings, in comparison to other settings, whether it's in local authorities, family hubs that we work in, is this resistance. And it's typically from parents and carers where actually they're not ready to be able to acknowledge that either they're in a domestic abusive, it's an abusive relationship, or that it's had an impact on the children and young people. So I feel because of where schools are at in that really early intervention, which is why I came into education, because actually great opportunity to be able to support children and families, but sometimes parents are not themselves ready to be able to engage, and therefore that has a knock-on effect on their child.
Yeah, of course. It will. Again, from my own experience working with families, incredible when engagement's high and incredibly challenging when it's not. And, you know, there's everyone who's listening will have their stories of real success, but also times where they wish it would have gone better, I'm sure, you know, from that thing. And, you know, hindsight being 2020 as it is, we look back and we wonder about how much. Often, I think as practitioners, we often look back and we look at ourselves all the time and the things we can change and what we should have done differently. But actually, you're right. Sometimes it is about the other people in that relationship and the other people in that kind of team around that young person not being ready to do the work then. And, you know, you hope that maybe the work that you've done has sown that little seed, you know, that will grow over time. And, you know, even in 10 years, they may go, bang, I know what Sam was talking about now.
Yeah.
I know what Ashton meant. Brilliant. That's kind of the bit. As I left education, it's the bit that I kind of hoped I'd left people with a bit of a something that in 10, 15, 20 years, it might click. I don't know. There's a lot of hope at that point. What do you think the biggest misconceptions are then? We've talked about the bigger knowledge base and foundational understanding and schools becoming more informed at a kind of more general level. But what do you think are still the biggest misconceptions that schools have about children's mental health?
Some of the terms that we hear, so they're doing it for attention seeking. It is manipulative. So the behaviours that they're displaying are to manipulate the adults around them. I think there's a lot of misconceptions around people using their mental health as an excuse. And often it's when the adults are struggling. So it might be schools are on their trauma-informed journey, they're more aware, they're supportive typically, but there's so many of the competing priorities that's taking place for the school, for the staff, that they revert back to old ways of thinking, old ways of practice. So often then we get this kind of where empathy for the young person starts to reduce, because once you deem that a child is attention-seeking or they're manipulating, how you respond to them is going to not be very favourable, is going to have low empathy, because how we perceive what attention seekers are like and how we just have this automatic dislike. I think there's something as well around people understanding self-harm and suicide, that it's not a mental health disorder. They get fixated again on the behaviour, or saying, well, actually, mm-hmm. the student is persistently having thoughts around suicide. And then they're saying, well, they're not safe to come into school. And trying to have that conversation, so but the thoughts, actually, those thoughts could be keeping them alive. So how do we try and change those conceptions people have got about young people and their mental health and well-being? Because we are moving into, and you do hear the words and the being just thrown around. So people saying, I'm just depressed. They're not depressed. They're low for the day, or the mood's fluctuating, or they've woke up today and thought, you know what, I can't bother to going to work or going to school, etc. But the terms that I use, the language we're using, is just being bounced around.
Yeah. But there's a flippancy around some of the terminologies, isn't there, that in society that can be quite detrimental to supporting children and young people. And, you know, it can create stigma and labels where it's unnecessary. Yeah. And it can stir up conversations that are incredibly unhelpful. I mean, like you said, trying to reframe people's understandings of their own hooks and triggers, and, you know, how their own difficulties, challenges, concerns, things that they've been through, their own experiences that may be impacting their judgment or their ability to work with someone is a really tough conversation. I mean, there's definitely occasions over the years where I'd like pull, I'm sure, like say to someone, it's probably best that you don't work with this young person or this family, or, you know, let's move you around. Good. I guess the impact of good supervision, that must be a huge part of the work that you do with both staff and your clinical teams.
Yeah, so clinical supervision. So that was another thing that I was so surprised when I moved over, I guess. As a clinician, we have access to clinical supervision. We have to maintain our registration.
Yep.
And then you come into education and you've got frontline practitioners that are working day in and day out with young people that are experiencing mental ill health, varying degrees. Mm-hmm. They're reading, they're seeing lots of traumatic information. They're going to be vulnerable to vicarious trauma. They're going to be seeing and processing lots of traumatic information. And then they don't have nowhere to go and process that information through clinical supervision. They have no access to reflective practice. So day in, day out, they're just functioning on this adrenaline of kind of one crisis to the next thing to support, to... Then there'll be a big incident that takes place, and it might not be until the end of the day or the following day that there's some discussion, but usually that's in a morning briefing or the end of day briefing, where actually it's everything else on top of that, like day-to-day business.
Absolutely. So, it's like case management at that point, isn't it? It's just checking off the checklist of things we have to do today.
Yeah. And responding to the next crisis or the next curveball that's been thrown your way, the unexpected stuff that comes along. So really championing about access to clinical supervision. So what we're finding now in schools is where schools are approaching saying, our designated safeguarding leads need clinical supervision, our SENCO do. Or actually, we've got a staff member that they're going through a safeguarding process themselves, so they're a part of that process that's affecting them. Can they have somewhere to be able to go? And again, it's not therapy. There's this kind of, I guess, misconception about what clinical supervision is. It's not therapy. But it is that time that to enable you to process and reflect, really think about what's my practice, even get support from a clinician to be able to say around risk management or other models to be able to look at. But the biggest difficulty in education is the priority of time. Because sometimes then what we get is people saying, what we say about every 6 weeks is good, because then you can form that relationship with your supervisor, have it midterm, like halfway through, so you've got things to be able to talk about, and actually then you're supported through the second half of term.
Yeah.
But then because of time and resource and all the pressures, then you get people trying to extend it to a couple of months, 3 months, and then the value of it goes.
Once you miss that one when it's at that cadence, it's pretty much written off, isn't it? I honestly, I'm absolutely with you. I will fly the flag for supervision any day of the week. I think some of the best places I've experienced with good clinical supervision are the ones where it's been, I guess, evangelized by someone who's going through it, who has their own supervision in place. It's very, very difficult in the day-to-day runnings of an educational institution to fly the flag high enough to raise it above the parapet of every other flag in the school that's being flown for their areas and their things, without actually the person that you're selling it to, as a DSL, for example, if you're selling it to your leadership team, if they've seen the value in it and they've been a part of it, then they will make time and space for it, is my experience. I'm not saying that's going to be true for everyone, but I've had so many occasions where speaking to staff about the value of clinical supervision has ended with, I don't need that. There's no wrong with me. You know, those types of conversations. It's like, no, I'm all right. I don't need therapy. I just need a drink. I just need to go get a wine. Well, you know, those types of even flippant remarks, not suggesting that they were going to go get a drink at 4 o'clock in the afternoon or whatever, to deal with everything that's gone on. But those flippant responses to wanting to put 30 minutes in a week just to discuss how someone's sitting with the things that they're managing, is either goes down incredibly well or takes a nosedive and never takes off, was my own experience of it. And frustrating.
I think if we rephrase it to say, actually doing the children a disservice if we're not engaging, because if you've got staff members functioning where they're actually pouring from the empty cup, that they haven't got the time to process what's going on. They don't have the time to just generally stop and reflect and think, okay, what's going on for me? What's the impact it's having on me? What impact does that have on my engagement with the young people?
That window of tolerance to manage stuff that's going on in the day when you've not got that space.
That means you're not functioning at the full capacity that you should be for the students. And that's what we're there for, is for these young people. So I always flip it and say, okay, well, what you're telling me is not a priority. Because when somebody says, I don't have the time, it's not that I don't have the time, it's not a priority for them. So when we get DSLs and SENCOs, et cetera, and pastoral leads coming in and saying about clinical supervision, there's also some coaching around how do you educate and upskill leadership team or the board of governors to be able to say, actually, this is where a resource needs to be allocated to.
And do you think, because one of the other questions I was going to ask you today was around like kind of what you think is what the particular pressures on schools are right now. And I assume one of the things that you would think would suggest is time and prioritization of this type of stuff is tough in schools when they're busy, when they've got everything going on, when interventions and support for young people is just one piece of that pie that they're managing in the day with attainment, assessment, behaviours. You know, running the day. But what else is going on in schools then that you think is a particular pressure that worries you the most, I guess, from your perspective and experience?
But the stuff that we're seeing is senior leadership team, their mental health and wellbeing. So many are coming to a point where they're talking about generally just sitting in the car, breaking down before they even go home. Themselves on Sunday experiencing thoughts around self-harm, suicide ideation. Can't cope, their mood is so low, struggling to put on that kind of front
to
the team and kind of move forward with that. And then also recognizing that maybe they're the main income in the household. So what do I do instead of being a head teacher or a deputy or an assistant head? So senior leaders' mental health, definitely. And people maybe not checking in. I know leading a team myself, it's quite a lonely place to be.
Yeah, absolutely.
Everybody else, but no one's really, and you're focused so much on everybody else and everything that needs to get done that you deprioritize yourself and you're not very good at prioritizing yourself.
The pyramid effect, like you're at the top and you're kind of looking after everyone else and you feel like you've got to stay steady for them. That's tough because that's all like what you're talking about there with the leadership teams and things like that that you've experienced. I guess the majority of that is very internalized. So people are doing it outwardly, maybe in their own space and time, but they get to school and they're trying to, like you say, put on that front.
Yeah.
People are thinking, oh, Sam's fine. He seemed chipper today. Not a problem. And that that just feels like a ticking time bomb on mental health.
And if you think about safeguarding perspective, are you checking in on your senior leadership team and their mental health and wellbeing? Are you safeguarding them?
Yeah.
And you
safeguards the safeguarder.
Yeah, absolutely. And then parents, the pressure from parents and carers. So time and resources spent where they're responding to parents and carers, where they maybe feel disgruntled, something that's not done right, or they want something better. That actually, that becomes quite difficult.
That firefighting.
All their resource and energy spent on doing things, of responding to those, instead of doing the things that actually drew them into education in the first place. So then that job satisfaction starts to disintegrate. You've got so much pressure on schools. Every time there's a new initiative by the government, schools are always in there somewhere. The VORC strategies come out. We're talking about schools now having to do work around relationships and kind of targeting young boys. It's not great that we've got maybe PE teacher, English teacher, maths teacher then taking on this responsibility of something else. That's not their area of specialism and expertise. But we just seem to think, well, because they're in schools and it's early intervention, it's prevention, we'll give it schools to do. So this ongoing pressure of depending on what's going on politically as well.
That is such an interesting topic, isn't it, in terms of, because I've always felt like the political landscape and policy and procedure, particularly now I've come to work for CPOMS, always feels a bit behind where times are. It's like they're always playing catch up with policy. And I was still in schools at the time that the mental health lead qualifications and all those things came out. And I left just as I felt like it was probably getting to the point where it had kind of been diluted too much, and kind of I felt like there was nothing beyond go for this qualification. You must have one in school. But there's no onward support or guidance about what this qualification looked like, or even really a decent understanding of what qualities a person should bring to the role, other than you need one in post and you can get it through this provider cheap. I've lost touch with some of that stuff, but it feels like one of those things where policy kind of had good intentions but didn't follow through with the support and kind of the clinical supervision element and the who does this person go to and what's this job really for? It felt very...
Yeah, it's funny you should say that, because we were as a provider for the DfE funding that came out for senior mental health leads training. And when we looked at the specification, I thought, I've done half a job again. What we're getting is training for mental health leads. We're going to get them to audit themselves, create an action plan, and we're going to sign off to say they've done the training. And I'm like, well, the impact comes in implementation, which is why we gave out.
And that's not a 1-6-7 month journey, is it? The implementation of something like that. I mean, that's the equivalent of, going and buying a fancy sports car that needs constant maintenance and servicing and, care. You can't just be throwing it out there, driving it 1,000 miles and expecting it not to need any attention. It's doing that action plan and is not the be all and end all, I wouldn't have thought.
No, and that's where we saw incredible results, because we gave access to EduPod to help them on that implementation journey and ongoing coaching for 12 months. And so many people were either nominated because they had an interest in mental health, or they was leading mental health, the strategy, actually just didn't know where to start. So being able to actually say, okay, this is what the government's going to be doing, but this is what we're going to be doing to support schools, is where I guess I thrive in, because it's not just about tick box. We've got a genuine opportunity to make a difference. And then being able to walk into a school and speak to a student, say, from that work that they did around mental health, I'm now heard and I'm seen. And they're sharing their YouTube video because they're making their own music now at school, and they was like keen to share that with us, all from that strategy around the implementation of the whole school approach. So that's where schools need support with, like, it's handholding them, and not because they can't do it and they're lazy. Capacity and the competing priorities and everything else that they're faced with, it's an industry like no other industry I've seen. They work in 6-7 week blocks and then a break. Every other industry, you take your own annual leave when you're ready for it.
They do like 5 jobs in that 6-7 week block as well, like one individual. It's like working full time 3 different ways.
Yeah.
It's a incredibly unique place to be.
Absolutely. And then by week five, week six, you kind of know some, like, your brain's coming up. So everyone's crawling to the end.
Then the body's shut down in half term.
And then guess what?
Many a half term flu.
Yeah, you're unwell because you've not processed anything that you've experienced. So you go off, you're unwell, unexplained aches and pains, just about settle in and relax, and it's time to come back again. So it is
a dangerous cycle.
Yeah.
Just thinking about the bit you touched on there, just for the sake of some of the listeners who might not know much about it, do you just want to give us a moment just to talk about what EduPod it is and what it does?
So EduPod,
their understanding.
EduPod was actually, it was a brain dump. So when I first started Innovating Minds, I worked for a school. It's a school for children with social, emotional, mental health needs. And it basically become a dumping ground for children that had been kicked out of education. And new senior leadership team had come in, and they'd taken over an academy trust, and they knew they wanted to do something different. And there was trying for about 12 to 18 months, so much training, so much support. One of their students that everybody wanted to give detention to completed suicide. And they just knew they had to do something differently, but didn't know quite what.
Yeah.
So I started working with the school. And within an academic year, we managed to turn everything around. We've got students accessing their learning. We've got students getting their mental health needs met. And there's a reduction in behaviour incidences by 90%. We've got children disclosing that they're having suicide ideation. The maintenance man was upscaled to be able to support those students, because a lot of the disclosures were coming actually through, like, maintenance man, the admin staff, the kind of wider support team.
Those key adults, key contacts weren't the people that someone would have written down on paper initially.
Absolutely. And
power of relationship, eh?
I know.
Those people who kind of knew them and in passing and were there, I guess, had those, think about, I don't know, like transactional theory, who had the most little like mini transactions and positives with them throughout the day. No load on those transactions, just hi, hello, absolutely, how are you doing? It meant a lot to those young people.
So we completely changed the ethos of the school, and it was basically the whole school approach to mental health. So it's like, how can we do this at a more scalable and more affordable way for schools, that they can go on their journey, embed the whole school approach to mental health in a way that actually is practical? So there's so much theory and principles, but actually what does that mean in practice? What are you looking out for? So EduPod I created off the back of that. How can we support schools go through that process? So you can audit yourself, and the we've got five principles, which encompasses the eight public health principles. How do you send out a survey? So we've got surveys in there to capture voices. How do you get the results? So much time is being spent where people are having to number crunch themselves, and then by the time they do the number crunch, and the data is outdated anyway, that they have to start again.
Yeah, so that's that maintenance we talked about, isn't it? When you're doing anything like this, you know, there needs to be an element of devotion to crunching those numbers, seeing the outcomes, readjusting, fine-tuning.
How do you then create action plans based on that data? So in the EduPod, it's recommended action plans based on your scoring. You can create your own. It keeps everything in one place. And then there's a load of resources, probably over 1,000 resources in there now, where it actually supports you with the implementation piece. And then you've got coaching, and you've got accreditation to be able to acknowledge the journey you are from committed to achieving, excelling. We just don't give awards out for the sake of it. Too many schools are chasing kite marks and not doing the do. So how do we support them on that journey? So EduPod is now used across the UK to support the mental health lead with that whole school approach to mental health. Because for me, if we can make change systemically, then actually we're going to have a bigger impact on staff and on students and parents and carers.
Absolutely.
As opposed to waiting for me as a therapist to come in and say X amount of sessions for this young person, or we need a counsellor in the school, because it de-skills the staff around the young person.
It does. And that, I mean, that is an incredible story of, I mean, it's so sad that it had to come, like tragedy had to be the catalyst for this. But, and I hope the young person who was involved in that tragedy, you know, clearly had a lot going on, and hopefully everything that you did in that setting and have continued to do for that setting has hopefully prevented a lot more incidents like that. Edupod sounds incredible. I thought it'd be worth just touching on, because there'll be people listening here who've maybe early on in their journey of managing emotional health, well-being and mental health in schools. And like you say, if you stick with just standard guidance, there's not a lot of direction or understanding there. And I think one of the things that we know about our educationalists who are kind of heavy in the field and who are really kind of evangelists for this type of work is they never do anything half-cocked. You know, the people that I've worked with over time have been the most dedicated and well-informed people, you know, who are making a difference, and to their detriment a lot of the time.
Yeah.
With their own mental health, unfortunately, which I think where you're right, it becomes this has to be a systemic solution to support these people. And I feel like there's like a psychological permission needed from policy, government, leadership to say it's okay to take 5. I couldn't even convince some people to have a tea break or have their lunch on some days, never mind see someone for clinical supervision.
Not even that, just even going to the toilet. I was delivering
simple Maslow's hierarchy stuff.
Yeah. I was delivering trying on vicarious trauma, and how many people get stopped going to the toilet, or you put it off,
yeah,
or you're on your way and you let somebody know I'm going to the toilet and they're still talking to you. I've been in a school setting, I'm about to enter the cubicle and I'm still
in the toilet, yeah,
to me. So we have to find ways to, how do we let people get breaks?
And how many times is it normalized in a busy office? And it's almost seen as like a badge of honor to say, I've not had a lunch break today. Or I've not even been to the toilet today. It's the first time I've sat down. I think like it's almost like a badge of honor to have a cold coffee on the desk. Or, you know, it's normalized to be flippant about people. Ooh, you've had a lunch break. Oof. Which I was that lucky. It's unintentionally, probably through coping, but an unintentional toxic atmosphere can be created sometimes with where it's almost seen as like a, I don't know, like a weak trait to go to the toilet to have a lunch break in some places I've worked. It's very strange how it.
Yeah, and I'm hoping that's changing more so now. I know when I was qualified, you wouldn't know it was home time in our office and you wouldn't know it was lunchtime. So, and I was the least qualified one there. I was the last one in. But for me, I was like, well, actually, no, like, it's important. We can't be talking about looking after everybody else and then you're not looking after yourself. But then what gradually happened was actually people welcomed the fact that I was doing that. And then other people would start joining me for lunch and then recognizing actually it's 5 o'clock, it's time to go. So I feel like that culture is somewhat changing. You might still see it depending on where you are. And again, it sets by leadership team and the people around you. So are you letting people know and giving permission that it's okay to take breaks? So some of my team, they'll come and log in early and say, actually, I want to take an hour because I'm going to take the dog for a walk, or I'm going to play in the snow with my daughter. So I'm going to take my lunch here and that. So schools, the flexibility is very different. And it's difficult to do, but actually where I've seen it work best is when everyone's working together, that you can create that flexibility and everybody protects the culture. Nobody takes it for granted or misuses it because everybody's benefiting from it.
There's a structure in place in school without a doubt that's different to an office job or any other place of work, but there is still space.
Absolutely. Yeah.
We can't get distracted. The setting and the environment is so unique that you can't change. It just needs different processes and different approaches.
And often people are not asking for too much. It's not like people are being unreasonable in their requests.
Just a toilet, Asha. Yeah. I just want a wee. Like, I mean, it's not a difficult. I'm not asking for the earth here. I want to get from A to B without three people stopping me and asking me a question or expecting me to go off and, you know, manage a situation.
And actually, whilst we're on the toilet conversation, which is not something I thought I'd say in a podcast.
Episode one on a podcast, yes. This is where the magic happens. These are the conversations that matter, Asha.
So one of my good friends is a paediatric consultant, and I'll ask her, what are you seeing? What's going on? She was specialising in renal, and they're seeing a massive increase in young people having renal difficulties because of schools and toileting, asking children
the whole holding of it.
Yeah. Children having to wait until it's break time, or children saying break time's not long enough because of the queues, etc. So she spends her time
Kids not wanting to go because of the atmosphere in the toilets or the environment sometimes.
It could be a range of things.
My young child has that going on at the moment, where they just don't want to do it at school because it's just, it's gross.
So she spends her time writing letters to school to say this child needs to go to the toilet and not to be stopped. So if we're talking about trauma-informed practice, mental health and well-being, actually what we know about trauma is how it presents in the body. So therefore a young person that's experienced trauma may also be experiencing anxiety. From a bowel movement perspective, they need to go to the toilet more frequently. They're not just trying to get out of your lesson because they don't like it and they're using the toilet as an excuse. We know actually there's an increase in either that they need to use the toilet. But we put these blanket approaches in this policies and procedures where it doesn't allow them to. Now, in healthcare, where I came from, that's institutional abuse. Blanket policies, procedures, stopping people from doing things that actually doesn't apply to them. We term it as institutional abuse. And as clinicians, you make sure that every practice and every restriction you was putting in place for somebody, you could understand evidence why that was in place and it had been reviewed and can it be revoked. But we don't do the same in health, in education.
No, it's interesting, isn't it? And I think, like you say, that if we look at the, even just like kind of that hierarchy of interventions in schools, whether it be one-to-one, whole school approach, targeted group work, beyond school interventions with third parties coming in and going to the experts for that support, something like this is really not a complex intervention to consider and put in play. And there are some very complex ones out there, people peddling a lot of stuff that can be detrimental to, the school, the site, the people, the kids involved, everyone. But that something like that's such a simple one. But then we talk about intervention and the different types of intervention, and it sounds like you've been involved in all different areas of intervention, like the extreme ends, where it's you're doing it after the fact, you're doing that intervention work to rehabilitate and reintroduce people back into society and, hopefully successfully. And then in schools, the hot topic is always early intervention. Mm-hmm. We talked about that over kind of your 10 years, that we hope that we're moving further into primary schools with the intervention that we do. Seems like there's a bigger appetite for working with younger people to try and prevent longer term problems and problems arising at an older age. What do you think? This is a really tough question, I think, but we can try and unpick it. What do you think early intervention actually looks like for a school setting?
Yeah, so for me, early intervention in a school setting is first upskilling the frontline practitioners, the people working in the school, particularly around trauma-informed practice. Because if you underpin trauma-informed practice to all of your work, you're going to affect everybody and help everybody. My bugbear, it's called trauma-informed practice because actually this way of working should be for everybody, regardless if we know they've experienced trauma or not.
Do you feel like there's a bit of a stigma attached to the terminology nowadays that makes it a barrier for people accepting it?
As a way of being.
That'd be a solid experiment, wouldn't it? I should repackage everything trauma-informed practice as
something.
Assessment outcome-focused approach to education and just see if that suddenly the uptake is different and people go at it differently.
Yeah, but I think if we support for that understanding, and particularly around a body-based approach, instead of moving from early thinking of early intervention is we've got to get children to talk. We often hear like, if only they opened up, if only they just talked about it. Well, actually, we know that doesn't process trauma. It doesn't help the young people. It actually re-traumatize them through that experience. They might not have the language, they might not be able to articulate how they're feeling. A lot of adults can't articulate how they're feeling. If you ask an adult, how are you feeling? They usually tell you what they've been doing.
Well, we just discussed that they wouldn't, a lot of people come against won't even access clinical supervision. Yeah. to talk about how things are going. So how we expect that in the young people that we're in charge of is, it's interesting, isn't it? Double standard.
And then for us to think about how do we even, so we resource the practitioners. How do we look at the physical environment? How do we think about the colours we use and the notice boards, the information, the dining room experience, the instructor time during break times? How do we look at people being welcomed into the school and leaving the school? All those, the language that's been used, the tone of voice, the way people are talking to each other, all of those things then start to support early help and early intervention. Because what we're not saying actually now you're presenting with mental health difficulties, we're going to do X, Y, Z. We're supporting everybody to feel safe and secure and calm.
Yeah. What's interesting about that is what you're explaining there, tell me if I'm wrong, I might have reframed it badly, but what you're explaining there is a reshaping of the day-to-day interactions with young people and the approaches to kind of being in relationship, none of which is resource heavy or costs.
Yes.
What we're saying here is just think about the way you're interacting with a young person and do it this way instead of that. Don't dismiss this, be inquisitive about that. Say it in this way, not that way. Reframe a sentence to be a little bit more positive and engaging rather than dismissive and negative. But you'll get the same result.
You get a better result.
You're not asking for the earth here. It's not spend this amount of money on this thing to do this that's specific.
No.
And I think that's a really interesting approach, because one of the things I found the hardest when I was dealing with like complex young people in schools is people that I worked with found it very, very difficult to transfer the knowledge from young person to young person to young person. So I would offer advice, support and guidance around child X. Child Y would present very similar in a month's time. And they wouldn't have even have tried the stuff that previously worked for another young person because they felt like it was so bespoke. Like, no, this is just relational, like adjusting the way you are in relation with this young person, repositioning kind of how you're being with them. And this is not specialist to this young person and their trauma. This is just good practice. So it's interesting how it kind of unfolds when people think, because the clinicians in it must be for this kid. These notes are for this child, therefore it doesn't apply.
And I think, I guess our superpower is about being able to put the theory into practice and say, actually, mm-hmm. this is where you can embed it. And this is a platform. This is an existing infrastructure you've already got within your school. This is not about giving you more work to do. This is about how can we do things slightly different in already what you're doing to get better results and outcomes, but also to give you internal capacity and sustainability. We know resources are very difficult in schools, financial resources, people, time, that actually if we can create that internal capacity, then that's great for the school and for the students because everybody's touched by it. You don't have to wait for an expert to come in to be able to offer it.
And that'll level you up straight away. Yeah. What you're talking about now just levels you up straight away to a better base, a better foundation for doing the more specific work from if needed.
And what we've seen, so we offer the Healing Together program. So we train frontline practitioners within schools to become trauma-informed practitioners and deliver our programs, because it's no good offering training and then not giving the resources to implement the training. So a lot of people now saying, and schools are saying, actually, we're trauma aware, but I wouldn't say we're trauma informed. And often it's because they don't know then what do you do next? They don't have the confidence. They don't want to say anything wrong. They don't want to do anything wrong. Yeah. People don't do anything at all. Similarly in safeguarding.
Yeah.
So with the Healing Together program, they have the 6-session resources to be able to deliver the children, young people, but they get that ongoing support and coaching and CPD. Now, what we've seen with those facilitators is that they get an increase in job satisfaction because they can see the difference they're making for students and with students. Yeah. And that's why people are there. They need the human. They need that feedback. Yes, we might think, okay, 10 years down the line, 20 years down the line, they're going to remember me and the relationship. But we're driven for feedback. We want to see progress. We want to see.
It's infectious, isn't it? Yeah. You know, it really is infectious when you can celebrate with a team around a young person or a family about those wins. And, you know, not looking at everything through rose-tinted specs. It's not, you know, from what you're saying here, it's not about just glazing over the difficulties. And it's not about, which I guess is another perceived thing with anything trauma-informed, it's not about not telling children off or not correcting behaviour or not setting ground rules in the school and not having kind of ways that we should be in an environment like a school setting. But it's much more than just washing over that, like some people think. It's about changing the dynamics and the relationships in that building to make better outcomes.
Yeah, and we do hear that. Is trauma-informed practice too woolly?
Yeah.
Is it just letting children get away with it?
Yeah.
And actually, often we find that when the trauma-informed principles doesn't align well with you. So if your values, your beliefs are very much of a thing that actually children come here to learn, we're the adult, they're the child, this is the rules, this is the consequences, then trauma-informed practice doesn't align well for you. So we always have to ask the question, this school is going on this direction, this is the process, this is the practice. Does it align with you? If not, do you still want to work here?
And if you're looking this far ahead and you've got this far to have a conversation with me, you're clearly not happy with how school is at the moment. So why not just try it? You know, it's not going to, promise you it won't make it worse, but it might just make things better. So give it a go.
Some don't. And then you get unconscious sabotage taking place or conscious sabotage. And that's really difficult to manage because staff end up babysitting staff. And it creates so many dynamics and difficulties within school. So we've seen that too, where we've supported senior leadership team to really rethink strategy and the team members and actually are they the right people for this journey? Do they want to be here? And it's okay to say no, because,
What an interesting set. So I'm very conscious of time. I think it's been an incredibly detailed discussion. I think I'm hoping people who are on now still with us have really taken something out of this. The hope for anything around this podcast and thought leadership processes was around giving people a space to reflect on conversations that are going on. And, you know, if people are taking this time out, even if it's on the drive to work or whatever, thank you for doing it with us. I'll close us off there. Thank you so much for joining us. It's an absolute honour to have you on and for the first ever Safeguarding in Focus podcast. So thank you for being the first guest ever on our podcast from CPOMS.
Thank you. Thank you, Sam, so much for inviting me and also shining a light on this and for CPOMS recognising how important this is. How do we support and upskill those frontline practitioners that are making a real difference and want to learn more, that they've got this valuable opportunity?
Not a problem at all. Is there anything that you want to plug while you're on? Any places people should go to find out more information or things they should look for?
Yeah, so Innovating Minds. So innovatingmindsgroup.com is our website, so you can find out more information there. If you're interested in more content as well, trauma-informed content, follow me on LinkedIn. That's where I hang around and post a lot of content that's out there as well.
Great stuff. So if you're listening, you can subscribe to our podcast on your preferred podcast platform, just so you don't miss out on future engaging and insightful discussions. Thank you very much for listening, everybody. Thank you again to our guest, Tasha Patel. We'll see far more from her in the future, I'm sure. We'll see you all on episode 2. Take care.